Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Joe Moore. On today's program, are you ready to share the road with a Google-powered Prius? We'll take a look at what it will take to get California ready for a future filled with driverless cars. It's going to happen sooner than you might think. We'll get an update on the latest from the Aspen Fire burning in the San Joaquin River Gorge near Huntington Lake. We'll also cut through the chatter about Obamacare and ask important questions like, what does it mean to you, especially if you're someone who doesn't already have health insurance? Reporter Emily Bazar will join us to answer some important questions about signing up for coverage and more. And finally, we'll take a look at a summertime tradition in Clovis, the free weekly Bluegrass in the Park concert series. But first, we're over halfway through 2013, and you know what that means. Politicians up and down the state are gearing up for an election year that's right around the corner. We'll talk about the aftermath of last week's special election in the state Senate in just a moment. But first, who is aiming to be California's next governor? The first votes will be cast in less than 12 months, but you wouldn't know it from watching the campaign. Ben Adler reports from Sacramento on why the Republican field is shaping up so slowly to challenge Democratic Governor Jerry Brown.
Here's how the race looks right now. There's Assemblyman Tim Donnelly, a Tea Party hero, who announced his exploratory campaign on the conservative website politichicks.tv.
California needs somebody to stand up and fight, and somebody who believes that we can be the golden state again.
There's former Lieutenant Governor Abel Maldonado, who's making Jerry Brown's prison realignment program the linchpin of his campaign.
The people of California are not safe today. They are letting violent felons on the streets.
And there's Neil Kashkari, a former U.S. Treasury official who led the response to the stock market crash known as TARP. He's not formally in the race, but he's been quietly laying the groundwork. Yet there's been hardly any talk about the campaign. GOP consultant Marty Wilson says he's never seen a governor's race start so slowly. And the biggest reason, he says, is Jerry Brown.
Brown has proven to be a very effective governor, and so trying to find the issues where you can draw contrast are going to be a challenge.
Conservative blogger John Fleischman doesn't think any of the three candidates could excite the party's base and raise enough money to win.
Most credible people don't believe that Abel Maldonado even has a shot to do that. Kashkari is unknown, and while Tim Donnelly is certainly an admired member of the legislature, there's metrics that he would need to reach to demonstrate he would have the ability to take on Jerry Brown.
Voting by mail begins in less than 10 months. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
So what about Governor Brown? He hasn't officially announced if he's running for re-election, but a newly released poll shows he's got support should he choose to. A field poll shows Brown has a 51% job approval rating among registered voters in California, but that's actually a 6-point drop from last February. Still, 68% of rank-and-file Democrats support Brown's job performance. 43% of registered voters would support his re-election bid if he decides to run. Counties south of Los Angeles showed the most opposition to a Brown re-election, while counties in the San Francisco Bay Area were the most supportive. Men were more likely to support another term for Brown than women, 47% to 40%. Here to talk some more about politics, we have two guests joining us live in our studio, Fresno State political science professors Jeff Cummins and Thomas Holyoke. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
Hello.
Let's start out with this governor's race. We heard the report from Ben Adler about the GOP field. Is there a reason, starting out with you, Jeff, that you think that the field has been so slow to coalesce at this point in the election cycle?
Yeah, one of the things that comes to mind in terms of the lack of the number of candidates is in political science we refer to this theory of the strategic politicians, and what potential challengers do is they look at the approval rating of the incumbent, and you just ran through the numbers on Governor Brown, and they look at the condition of the economy. Those are pretty much the two basic factors that they look at, and if those are in favor of a challenger. So you would want lower approval ratings for the incumbent. You would want a poor economy. Then you tend to get more challengers. But we're not seeing that from the lack of strong challengers, because the governor's generally done a pretty good job of turning the state around And the economy is moving in a much better direction than it had been during the Great Recession.
And when you combine that with the cost of running for governor in California, it makes it even more challenging. Turning to you, Tom, when it comes to running for governor, if you are, let's say, an up-and-coming member of the opposition party, in this case the Republicans, is this a year that maybe you want to lay low and wait for another election cycle if you're a top-tier potential candidate?
I would say so. You would want, you'd probably be looking more at 4 more years later. I mean, Jerry Brown, of course, has given no indication at all as to what his future is. But I would say that he would probably run for one more term and then probably, you know, pack it in after that. And as you say, running for governor in California is going to cost an enormous amount of money. And it's been my impression, it's looking back at the Prop 30 campaign, that some of the money, say, from some of the agricultural interests, for example, that might otherwise go to a Republican actually went to some things that Jerry Brown was sponsoring, because actually, Jerry Brown has not proven to be the great liberal that I think a lot of people thought he was going to be. He's been fairly conservative in spending. He only raised taxes with a vote of the people. He's trying to tackle a lot of the big water issues in the state. It's hard to find a good niche to really take on Jerry Brown right now if you're a Republican.
Let's talk a little more about the governor right now. You mentioned his stance politically in the overall spectrum. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it almost seems like Republicans in Sacramento and the legislature have almost shown more accord with this governor than they did the past governor, who was in their own party sometimes.
Yes, certainly true. Well, I think part of it is that Jerry Brown's had the advantage of being able to be governor at a time when the state's economy is improving, whether it's, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger got to preside over the collapse. And with a little more money to go around, a little more care, and frankly, in Jerry Brown's case, a little more experience, he's been able to avoid a lot of the pitfalls that, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, jumped right into.
Turning to you, Jeff, Jerry Brown, if he were to win re-election, would be in his 80s in his second term. Is that a concern for California voters? Brown, when he ran the first time, I don't know that he ruled out running for a second term, but it wasn't necessarily something that was on the agenda of voters.
I don't think it's a concern unless some health issue comes up. We, you know, kind of discuss this question with presidential candidates when they're tend to be in their 70s, getting closer to 80s. But I don't think it's an issue unless there's some reason to be concerned about it.
Going back to the Republican field and potential challengers there, Abel Maldonado is probably the highest profile name in the race, former lieutenant governor, former big role in the legislature, but he also alienated members of his own party with his vote to increase taxes under Governor Schwarzenegger. And while he might be someone who could help the GOP increase its base with Latino voters, there are also challenges with the traditional GOP base for Maldonado, are there not?
Yeah, I would agree. I think one of the things you're seeing right now with Maldonado and the other candidates that have been named is that they're looking for a vulnerability in Governor Brown, and there aren't many. So they're trying to take on the crime issue, trying to say that with the realignment that he put in place by shifting state prison inmates to the local level, that has increased crime and so on. So they're kind of trying to capitalize on that and see how much traction they can get with it. But if you just think about, aside from those, how well Governor Brown has done, how well the economy has done, the Republican Party is not in a good condition itself. We have these splits between what I consider the more modern Republicans, and then you have kind of the old school Republicans who tend to be more moderate. The modern Republicans tend to be a lot more conservative, so it's harder for them to come behind one candidate, which is what they would really need to take on a strong incumbent like Governor Brown.
And turning to you, Tom, Tim Donnelly is someone who's getting some attention. He is a Tea Party favorite. He's an active voice in the legislature, but is he really ready to take on a statewide campaign at this point?
Well, Tim Donnelly would appeal very strongly to a large part of the base of the Republican Party. But as Jeff was just saying, the base of the Republican Party in California is shrinking, and even some of its old strongholds like Orange County are not quite as Republican as they used to be. So Tim Donnelly would have to find a way to appeal much, much beyond his base to run an effective campaign for governor, and I'm just not sure that he can really do that.
We've been talking about Republicans. Now let's turn around and talk about Democrats. And there was something I read in the paper or online just a while ago about Governor Brown and Lieutenant Governor Newsom. And Newsom was complaining that in the entire time they've been in office, Newsom has not had a face-to-face meeting with the governor. The lieutenant governor's office in California is perhaps the most irrelevant in the state, except when the governor leaves the country or leaves the state. Gavin Newsom certainly is someone who has to have political ambition beyond where he's at right now. I could imagine that he has his eye on the governor's mansion coming up, not the governor's mansion anymore, but the eye on the governor's seat after Jerry Brown. What about his political future at this point? Is he stuck in a dead end right now?
I would probably describe it more as a holding pattern. the lieutenant governor's position is not really a great launching pad for running for governor. There are exceptions to that, but really, it's historically in the state, it's been the attorney general's office. So you'd have to kind of look to Kamala Harris as the main front runner for a successor to Jerry Brown. But I would say that Gavin Newsom definitely has some gubernatorial ambitions. It's just a matter of kind of picking the right time for him to run. One of the problems with being in the lieutenant governor's office is you're not able to build a record of activity. All you do is sit on some boards and commissions, and you try and make some noise.
He named the state fruit the avocado for the rest of the year, or something like that.
I don't know that that's going to be enough.
Aliens the fruit growers.
Exactly. What about you, Tom? What do you think about Gavin Newsom's potential politically in California moving forward?
Gavin Newsom has not been able to get his name out in front of the public much in the last couple of years, I think. And Jeff here mentions Kamala Harris, who has done a good job in getting her name out there. In fact, I think if anyone's seen as the rising star of the Democratic Party in California, it's Kamala Harris. She's been aggressive and pursuing banks that have been going after people in foreclosure. I think she made an appearance with the president, actually, on that subject, too. So I'd say that she's kind of the star of the left rising right now.
Let's turn more to a local angle and Senate District 16. A week ago today, the big election, and Andy Vidak pulls out another win, a Republican victory in a heavily Democratic district. A surprise, Tom?
Yes, a surprise. That's a district with, I think, 51% Democratic registration. We're just talking here about the shrinkage of the California Republican Party and is it relevant. But then this happens, and probably a good shot in the arm for a party that really needed a good shot in the arm. But it's a district that probably should have gone to the Democrats, and the Republicans pulled an upset.
Turning to you, Jeff, there's been a lot of talk about what went wrong. Where did Perez fail here? Did the connection with Michael Rubio and Chevron and the Chevron money that came in the primary, did that wind up hurting her in some way, tainting her?
I think it probably did. I mean, I think initially, I could be wrong on this, but she, on her campaign website, she originally had mentioned that she'd previously worked and served as a staffer, and then she took it down. To me, I think that's an indicator that she no longer wanted that link. I think it for those voters who knew about it, it probably and the connections and where Michael Rubio went and so on, I think that probably played on voters' minds as well. But I think it was definitely more than that. I think it was that she had problems connecting with voters. They perhaps questioned the fact that she had just barely been sitting on the Kern County Board of Supervisors, and now she was trying to jump to the state Senate. Not the state assembly, which is kind of the more natural progression. So I think it was a combination of different factors. You certainly can't point to fundraising and money, because money poured into this race from all sides. So. I think it was had to do with the candidate herself and perhaps the message, and then just the fact that Vidak had really good name recognition in this district.
Jeff, Tom, go ahead.
Oh, I don't really have much to add to that. I think Jeff summed it up pretty well. Leticia Perez was really only known down in Kern County, whereas Andy Vidak had already run against Jim Costa a couple of years back and came very, very close to beating him. So he had the advantage of name recognition. He had the advantage of experience.
There was a lot of money spent on media at the end. What about the importance of the ground game? I think getting out the vote is always important, but especially in a special election like this, low turnout overall certainly was more than in the primary. But still, what role did that play, the late money that came in? And was there anything for Republicans to build off of? Democrats traditionally have really strong ground games. Did the Republicans pull out something there with this race and at the end?
Well, Democrats have pretty good ground games during regular elections. When it comes to special elections, Republicans are a little better about turning out. And to a large extent, I think that happened this time. And to say that Andy Vidak did put together a very strong ground game in both rounds of this election, especially in his home turf in Kings County, where he really turned out a lot of people. And that, to some extent, gave him the margin he needed, because he ended up, I believe, losing Kern and Fresno counties. He just didn't lose it by enough to, to swing the election to Perez.
One last question before we go, and I'll leave it with you, Jeff. Leticia Perez, right after the election, had an appearance on The Daily Show, a big national profile thing. And the piece was basically a kind of funny piece about why she's not running for Congress. Her future political ambitions, give us your crystal ball.
I think what she may have learned from this race is that maybe she needs to gain experience on the board of supervisors, maybe kind of take the more natural progression up through political offices before she attempts to run for Congress. And of course, when you're making these types of decisions, as I said earlier, with challengers to the governor, you have challengers tend to look for these opportunities when the conditions are right. So I think eventually we're going to see her running for higher office again, but perhaps not right away, given her experience in this state Senate race.
Professors Jeff Cummins and Thomas Holyoke, thank you so much for joining us today about this discussion on state
thank
and local
you, Joe.
Politics.
Thanks.
This is Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. Smoke from the Aspen Fire could be seen hanging over much of the Fresno-Clovis area early this morning. The fire is burning in the rugged and steep terrain of the San Joaquin River Gorge near Huntington Lake. The lightning spark blaze has now burned over 14,000 acres in the Sierra National Forest since it began last Monday. As of this morning, officials say the fire is just 25% contained. Over 1,600 firefighters are currently working on the blaze, which has thus far cost $8 million to fight. Some of the best reporting on the fire and what it means for mountain communities in both Madera and Fresno counties has come from our next guest, Gina Clugston, the editor of the website Sierra News Online. Gina, welcome.
Good morning, Joe.
Thank you so much for joining us. You published a very interesting account, a firsthand account of the fire from the front lines as you drove up Mammoth Pool Road in Madera County yesterday. Tell us about what you saw.
Well, I was on the west side of the river, so the fire is on the east side, but I wanted to get good pictures, so I stayed away from the smoke. There are dozens of engines and hotshot crews all along Mammoth Pool Road, which is Forest Service 81. They have a contingency plan in place in case the fire comes across the river. So they're stationed all along the roadway watching the fire and watching for anything crossing over. And then if that were to happen, they have a plan in place to attack the fire immediately.
Is that a concern for communities on the other side of the river? North Fork's a ways away, but it is, I guess, in the general vicinity.
Oh, yes, absolutely. In the mornings, you know, this morning was pretty good. It wasn't too smoky, but generally for the last week when we get up in the morning, it's just smoked in. from the downslope breezes in the evening, and it usually takes until afternoon for the inversion to lift, which is one of the things that's been hampering the air attack over there, is it's been too smoky for them to use the aircraft that they have available. And, of course, as you saw from the photographs, this is very, very steep, rugged terrain, slabs of granite, and it's really been difficult for the ground attack. So a lot of what they've been accomplishing is through air attack, and the last couple of days they've had pretty good luck in the afternoon getting their aircraft in there. They're now staging all of their helicopters at the Old Mill site in North Fork, some very impressive, huge sky cranes and such. It saves them hours. Of course, the pilots are only allowed to fly so many hours, and the ships are only allowed to operate so many hours before they need maintenance. So it's saving them that way. It's closer to the fire for them to stage in North Fork than to go all the way back to Fresno.
I even understand they're using some jet aircraft. There's a DC-10 that's an air tanker that's dropping flame retardant in some of the areas. What are you hearing from some of the firefighters that you've talked to? I understand that you got a chance to meet up with some of them as they crossed over Mammoth Pool and in that general area.
Yeah, they are. The hotshot crews are staging at, they have a spike camp at Minaret's workstation. Of course, the road is closed all the way from Fish Creek up. The firefighters on the west side of the river, as I said, are just in preparation for the eventuality of the fire crossing over. I think they're really enjoying their duty because they just get to look at the beautiful scenery, and they're not on those tough fire lines across the way. They're just standing by on the west side.
What about what about evacuations on the west side? Have there been any for some of the folks that live in that area? Are they concerned?
Oh, yes. They've evacuated everyone from all the campgrounds all along there. And there are, I believe, two sections of private land up there where folks have cabins. And, yes, I've been contacted by people that, you know, they're real concerned with that. But at this point, the fire hasn't crossed the river. The river itself doesn't. It doesn't provide a real good fire break because there's not a lot of water in it. I believe I heard someone say it was only 70 feet wide. It's very steep terrain once it does cross over to this side of the river. But so far, the winds have been coming from the southwest, blowing everything toward the northeast where there's no structures or towns or anything. So that's been a real good or people keep people a little bit less nervous.
Well, Gina, thank you so much for relaying your reporting on this story with our listeners. Again, our guest today has been Gina Clugston. She's the editor of Sierra News Online. And go to their website, sierranewsonline.com, and click on her story, A Trip Up to the Aspen Fire. There's some very dramatic photographs and other accounts from the fire on Monday. Again, Gina Clugston, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe.
This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment and talk about driverless cars in California. Are you ready to share the road with a Google-powered Prius? We'll find out in just a moment. This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. What once sounded like the stuff of science fiction is now reality on the drawing board. Rapid advancements are being made in the field of driverless cars, and as KDO reports from Sacramento, California is working to get out ahead of the curve.
At a Ford dealership in northern Sacramento, Fleet sales manager Obeth Carlos Davila drives the new Ford Explorer off the lot. It's this year's version of the car of the future.
So as you approach the spot, then you just turn on the park assist button. It's looking. So it tells you when you need to stop.
Davila takes his foot off the gas and his hands off the wheel and watches the car steer itself into a parallel parking space.
Active park assist is done.
A self-parking car is a big step towards a future of self-driving cars. As you watch from the passenger seat, there's some anxiety and some amazement. There's an urge to grab the spinning steering wheel and brace for impact with the surrounding cars. But again and again, the car quickly and smoothly parks itself. Davila says self-driving cars could catch on once drivers are comfortable with giving up control.
But it's going to take a while. I mean, sounds good. I mean, who knows? We might have flying cars in about 10 years.
Meet George Jetson.
We've got our hands full with autonomous vehicles right now.
Bernard Soriano is deputy director of the California Department of Motor Vehicles. California is one of three states with laws allowing for some kind of driverless car. The legislature has directed the DMV to create regulations for them. Soriano says, for now, the rules won't let the public get driverless licenses.
By the end of this year, we hope to have the regulations in place to allow for the different manufacturers to test their vehicles, their autonomous vehicles, on our roadways. By January 2015, we'll be done with the regulations that will define the operation of these vehicles on our roadways.
So who can operate a driverless car? And would the operator have to sit in the driver's seat? Soriano says there are numerous questions yet to be answered.
The question of liability is one that just comes to mind immediately. I mean, who's responsible? What happened? Is it the operator, if the operator is not actually driving?
Soriano recently discussed driverless cars with about 300 colleagues at the second annual Road Vehicle Automation Conference at Stanford University. Researchers, manufacturers, and regulators all gathered to listen to industry leaders like Volkswagen and Google and collaborate on making the vehicles a reality. Conference organizer Steve Schladover is with the University of California and works with the state to ease traffic congestion. Schladover is also assisting in the development of driverless car regulations. He says California could become a national model.
The legislature has given us a really daunting task to come up with a set of regulations, but at the same time, that's an opportunity to take a national lead and identify what is the right way of doing this so that it can be both safe and can help the industry proceed.
But Schladover says California has a lot to lose if it gets the regulations wrong. For instance, developers could flee to Nevada, which also allows driverless cars. Back at the Sacramento Ford dealership, salesman Tyler Swedinsky is concerned about the jobs that could be lost when driverless cars hit the road. Truck drivers, taxi drivers, but not car salesmen.
I'd still sell cars. I would sell the driverless cars to people, and there would probably be a large markup on them if you don't have to drive it yourself. So
Swedinsky may have to wait a bit for that extra cash. Experts estimate it will be at least 2020 before driverless cars hit the showroom floor. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
It's no surprise that California is leading the way when it comes to driverless cars. The Golden State's love affair with the automobile is an enduring part of the state's history and its present day. But what happens when we try to connect our different modes of transportation? According to Zocalo Public Square's Joe Matthews, that's one area where we as a state have come up short. In this radio version of his weekly Connecting California column, Matthews asks why in a state that's spending billions on new rail projects, we fail to make the connection between planes and trains.
A riddle. If you land at a big city airport and there's no train there, where are you? The answer? California. Yes, San Francisco, I know you're the exception with a BART train stop inside SFO. But otherwise, the California rule is that we'll invest billions in our airports and billions in our trains, but we wouldn't dream of directly connecting the two. Instead, we taunt those who dare to dream. How else to explain the fact that so many of California's urban trains and trolleys come close to airports, but not close enough to take you all the way there? You can see planes coming in to land at San Diego's Lindbergh Field as you ride the city's charming trolleys, but the trolley won't take you to the airport. In San Jose, two train systems run near the airport, but a shuttle bus is required to reach them. In Southern California, the Metro Blue Line trains go to Long Beach, but not to its airport. For Californians, all these failures to connect may seem trifling, But taken together, they represent a form of self-sabotage for a state that is so dependent on its links to the world. The writer Carrie McWilliams describes Southern California as an island on the land, but the term applies to the entire state. An island requires the best possible transportation connections. But in today's California, we are cheap, and the infrastructure we need is expensive. When we build, we prioritize what's easy over what's important. California is about to start high-speed rail by building in the San Joaquin Valley, where it is relatively easy, instead of in urban transit centers, where it's hard. Nowhere is this mindset more evident than at California's busiest airport, LAX. A subway station touches the edge of the airport property, but doesn't go into the airport. Today, Los Angeles has a chance for redemption, but may blow it. Another metro rail is being extended to the LAX area, but two of the options being considered would end the train at the corner of Aviation and Century, more than a mile away from the airport. Given the billions being spent on airport modernization and metro rail expansion in LA, that's mind-blowing. One recent night, I parked my car at the corner of Aviation and Century and walked to Terminal 1 at LAX. I passed by fortress-like airport hotels and a Carl's Jr. The sidewalk was barely lit, and I tasted the exhaust as motorists on Century sped past me. The walk took me 25 minutes, and I wasn't carrying any luggage other than a notebook and a cell phone. This is life in the great California train tease. We're spending hundreds of billions on rail and airports, and we still keep missing our connections.
Silver wings shining in the sun.
That was Joe Matthews of Zocalo Public Square with his Connecting California column. We'll be back with more Valley Edition in just a moment, right after this.
They're taking you away and leaving me lonely. Silver wings.
I'm Ezra Romero with these news headlines.
For the second year in a row, California farmers are complaining of a worker shortage. Ben Adler reports from Sacramento on how the state's $43.5 billion agriculture industry is feeling the squeeze, and how consumers might too.
Last year, nearly two-thirds of farmers in a California Farm Bureau Federation survey said they didn't have enough workers to pick their crops. This year, says the Farm Bureau's Brian Little, it's a problem again. For farmers, that means
you're not able to do things in a timely manner. You're not able to do it as thoroughly or carefully as you might normally do. And it winds up affecting overall what you can do, the quality of the product you can produce, and ultimately the price that you might be able to get in the market.
Little blames the shortage on demographic and political trends, including an older Mexican population, a lower Mexican birth rate, and tighter U.S. border security. The crops feeling the squeeze over the past 2 years include cherries, wine grapes, leafy greens, strawberries, and peaches. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
For a third time, a California lawmaker has proposed legislation that would require cars to maintain a distance of at least 3 feet when passing a bicycle. The previous two bills were vetoed by Governor Jerry Brown. Katie Orr reports from Sacramento on why this time might be different.
The first version of the bill would have required drivers to slow down to 15 miles per hour when passing a bike. The second would have required drivers to cross double yellow lines, which would otherwise be illegal, to ensure they gave bikes enough space when passing them on a highway. Governor Jerry Brown vetoed both. The latest bill is sponsored by Assemblyman Stephen Bradford. He says this version would give drivers more discretion as to whether or not they want to cross the lines. If they choose not to, drivers must slow down and keep the required 3-foot distance until they can pass safely. Bradford says he believes his bill addresses the governor's concerns with the two previous efforts. It's currently making its way through the state Senate. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
A fatal limo fire in Northern California has brought about new state legislation aimed at improving limousine safety. The fire occurred last May. It claimed the lives of 5 women headed to a bridal shower. The women could not escape because the limo did not have emergency exits. Under one bill, All limos would be required to have exit features such as rear doors and pop-out windows. A separate bill would require limos to carry fire extinguishers in both the passenger and driver areas. Lou Stone of California Professional Firefighters says the bill addresses an important safety concern.
I think if the provisions of the legislation had been enacted, yeah, I think they could have been saved, because a limousine like that is what they call a dead-end corridor. You're trapped.
Stone says the bill could help avoid such tragedies in the future.
This is another example of something that a tragedy, and then the fire service, public safety officials look at it and go, how can we keep something like this from happening again?
The bills currently do not have any opposition and are scheduled to be taken back up in the state assembly when the legislature resumes. Two of the five women killed in the fire on the San Mateo Bridge last May were from Fresno. Both Nariza Fojas and Michelle Estrera were nurses at Community Regional Medical Center in Fresno. This is Valley Public Radio News.
Local funding for FM 89 comes from FM 89 Legacy Society members providing endowment funds for FM 89's future.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. In just a few months, Californians will start signing up for health coverage under the new health care law. Here to tell us more about the expansion of coverage under Obamacare is Emily Bazar, senior writer with the California Healthcare Foundation Center for Health Reporting at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC. Her Ask Emily column appears in newspapers across the state and online at kvpr.org and seeks to answer questions from the public about various aspects of the law. Emily, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
There was a Gallup poll from late June that indicated that 43% of uninsured Americans were unaware that they needed to get coverage by the end of the year. The state's health insurance exchange, Covered California, is about to launch this $240 million marketing campaign. How is the rollout of the expansion of coverage going in terms of awareness? You talk with people through your column every week. How is that going?
Joe, there's mass confusion, to be honest, about the law, and confusion may actually not be the correct word. As you say, a lot of people just don't know what will be required of them, and if they do know that they're required to have health insurance, which is a big piece of Obamacare, most people will be required to have health insurance, they don't really know how to get it or what may be available to them through Obamacare.
There's a lot of moving parts with this law and different things, and I think one of the challenges out there is, at least in the media, taking something that's very complex and making it real for people and saying, how does it affect me? How does it affect my situation? You're doing that with your column. What are some of the things that you're hearing, not so much in specifics, but looking at, I think you've done 8 or 9 of these now, looking at them in totality, what are the types of things that you are hearing from people? Are there common threads?
It's a great question, and some of these common themes have surprised me, actually. I receive a lot of questions from people who already have health insurance through their employers but don't like it because it's too expensive or it doesn't offer them access to the doctor or hospital that they prefer. So I get a lot of questions from Californians who kind of want to get out of their work-based insurance and want to know if they can, if they will be eligible for subsidies through Covered California, the insurance exchange, or anything else. That's one big area that I'm getting questions about. I'm also receiving a lot of questions from parents about their young adult children or their college-age children about, you know, what suffices as health insurance for them. Can they keep their young adult kids on their own insurance? Can those, not kids, but young adults, can they get tax credits on the exchange? That's another area. Before, you may have heard that the federal government has delayed a piece of Obamacare by a year, and that is the requirement that large businesses with more than 50 full-time employees offer affordable health coverage. that's been delayed by a year. But I was getting a lot of questions from people asking me if it's legal for their employer to be cutting their hours. I've been hearing from people who said that their employers are trying to get out of the Obamacare requirement. But by far, the biggest number of questions I've received are from people from all over the state and, in fact, all over the nation who are giving me their particulars and asking me, can I get insurance under Obamacare? Most of them are uninsured or underinsured, and they want to know if they'll be able to get insurance.
Going back to what you just mentioned there with the decision to delay by a year the employer mandate, that affects a number of Californians and affects people because, in this case, somebody who may be employed, maybe had thought that they would be receiving coverage through their employer, now is going to have that responsibility under the law on their shoulders. Is the exchange ready to handle that? And what are those people going to do? What are the implications for that decision to delay that portion of the law?
Joe, it's not entirely clear how many Californians will be affected by that delay. However, you're absolutely right. Those people who might have gotten insurance through their employer starting in January are now kind of going to have to figure out how to do it themselves. And if they meet the income requirements, they may be eligible for tax subsidies on the health insurance exchange, which is covered California. Tax credits will be available to Californians who make between 138% and 400% of the federal poverty level. And this year, 400% of the federal poverty level equals about $46,000 for an individual or $94,000 for a family of four. Now, if they don't qualify, if they make too much money, they can still purchase on the exchange. However, they won't be eligible for this help from the federal government, so they'd have to pay the entire cost. If they make below 138% of the federal poverty level, and that's generally low-income folks, they may be eligible for Medi-Cal. So some of these folks who would have gotten insurance through their employers may be eligible for Medi-Cal, which is going to expand under Obamacare. Medi-Cal is California's version of the federal Medicaid program. More than 90% of large California employers already offer insurance to their employees. So, again, it isn't quite clear how big of an impact this will have.
Turning to the exchange, Covered California, this is something that we do know. There are a number of different plans that are available to Californians. Not all regions of the state have the same plans, as I understand it, but they have what are called standardized benefits or standardized plans. Can you explain what that means to somebody who might go on the website, who's interested in looking at the various plans and seeing how they compare? What does that mean?
That's a great question. So when the exchange says that all plans have standardized benefits, that basically just means that all plans will offer the same benefits. And what's different under Obamacare is that these plans have to meet or offer what are known as 10 essential health benefits, and they range from maternity coverage to prescription drug coverage. And in California, California's decided to say, okay, all of them will be the same, so that when a consumer goes and looks at these plans, they will be comparing apples to apples. In Fresno, Kings, and Madera counties, for instance, there will be a choice, it looks like, of four different plans. And they will range in price. Now, this is for a 40-year-old who chooses the baseline plan, and I can explain that more later if you'd like. But for a 40-year-old individual, the prices will range from between $238 to $333. Now, that's the maximum price. If you qualify for a tax credit, depending on how much money you make, they're sliding scale tax credits, you would pay less per month.
So then the choices that Californians have between the different plans largely involves the network and the participants in that network, would it not?
That's an extremely important point, and I hope to look into that more as the year continues. Yes. When consumers are making decisions about which plan to choose, they're going to need to look at which doctors and hospitals participate in those plans. one of the plans in Fresno Kings and Madera is Kaiser, so, you know, which people are pretty familiar with in California. You're pretty much limited to the Kaiser facilities and providers, but you'll have to look at, there's also Blue Shield and Anthem plans that are going to be offered. Does your doctor participate? If not, you know, are you willing to find another one, or do you want to go to a certain hospital that's closer to you? People will have to be very studious about making these decisions, and I hate to say it, it is complicated. I am doing this for a living, and I'm confused by it. And then I call experts to find the answers to these questions that readers send me, and I get different answers sometimes from experts. So it is a very complicated law, and people need to think carefully, and they also shouldn't be afraid to ask for help. My next column, which will be released today, gives a customer service phone number for Covered California, and I would like to give that to your listeners, too, if they're interested. They can call this number if they think they might be eligible for tax credits and get a sense of whether they will be and what choices may be available to them. And if they're not, maybe they're eligible for Medi-Cal. So they might get a sense now. They'll get more information as the year goes on. But if they'd like to call, the number is 888-975-1142. One more time, that's 888-975-1142. And that's California Health Exchange's customer service number, and they can actually talk to a real person in Spanish or in English.
Now, is that sort of the one-stop shop for people who have questions under the law? Because let's say that I'm a family that thinks that I might qualify under the Medi-Cal expansion. Do I call Covered California to find out about that, or do I call someone else?
Joe, another excellent question. You will call Covered California. In fact, you can call them now, and they can give you an idea. But starting, you know, later this year, the exchange starts in October, and that really means it starts for open enrollment, and coverage begins in January. But when you call the exchange starting then, you're supposed to only have to call one phone number and get the answer to any of your questions or sign up for Medi-Cal if you're not eligible for the exchange. So it's supposed to be this kind of, quote, one-stop shopping. I don't know that that can happen right now. They're really just getting rolling, as you know, but that's the intent at least.
What about small employers? How do they fit into this? The decision to roll back or push back the employer mandate for another year, that involves companies with 50 or more employees. What about those small businesses? How do they interact with the exchange? I understand there's provisions for them and their employees under the law.
That's true. The exchange is available to individuals and small businesses only. So large businesses can't purchase insurance for their employees through the exchange. But there's something called SHOP, and that will be for small businesses to shop around and provide insurance to their employees through the exchange. Now, small businesses also may be eligible for tax credits for offering their employees insurance, health insurance. But as you rightly noted, small businesses are not subject to the same requirement that they have to provide insurance that large businesses were.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, our guest is Emily Bazar. She is a reporter with the California Healthcare Foundation Center for Health Reporting at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC. Her Ask Emily column appears in newspapers across the state and online at kvpr.org. Emily, when we started out this conversation, you were mentioning individuals who already have coverage through their employer, and they're asking you whether they can qualify under the exchange, whether they can participate in that, maybe because their employer's coverage is too expensive or it doesn't offer access to the physician or network that they would like, the doctor that they would like. Can you elaborate a little more on what that means and some of the affordability gaps that are in there, as I understand it?
Absolutely. So if you have insurance through your employer but you don't like it, you can ditch it and you can go to the exchange and purchase insurance on the exchange. However, you may or may not be eligible for tax credits on the exchange. In order to be eligible for tax credits, you have to prove that your employer's insurance is, quote, unaffordable. And there's two kind of technical ways that you can prove that it's unaffordable. One is that the employee's share of the premium to cover him or herself only is more than 9.5% of annual household income. So if the employee can show that their plan is more expensive than that, then they can be eligible for tax credits on the exchange. Now, you very rightly pointed out a glitch, and there's something that's called either the kid glitch or the, quote, affordability glitch. What this means is that the employee alone needs to use his or her premium only to determine whether his or her insurance is unaffordable. So if the employee alone meets the affordability test, that means that that employee plus his or her dependents or family or spouse are not eligible for the exchange. But then if you, so that doesn't matter if you add the cost of the spouse or children's coverage. You can only use the employee's coverage to take the affordability test. And that means that some spouses and some children in that situation are going to be kind of priced out of tax credits on the exchange. It's a concern that a lot of people won't have access to those credits when they probably should.
Well, it's all very interesting, and I'm sure we have not heard the last about twists and turns in this story. Our guest today has been Emily Bazar, senior writer with the California Healthcare Foundation Center for Health Reporting at the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at USC. Her Ask Emily column appears in newspapers across the state and online at kvpr.org and seeks to answer questions from the public about various aspects of the new expansion of coverage under the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Emily, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and close out the show with a preview of Bluegrass in the Park in Clovis that's coming up next here on Valley Edition. Friday night, bluegrass fans from throughout the San Joaquin Valley gather in Old Town Clovis for what's become a summertime tradition. It's called Bluegrass in the Park. Here to tell us more about the event is Stan Allen. He's from the group the Kings River Bluegrass Festival. They not only produce the annual event every fall, but throughout the summer. They do this weekly concert series. Stan, welcome to Valley Public Radio.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
This has become a big tradition in Clovis. It's kind of a thing where you got the town square, the park in the middle of town, in downtown, and people gather. They bring their lawn chairs and sit down for a free concert. It's kind of a fun thing for families, isn't it?
It really is. It's a lot of fun. We've watched it grow. We've seen like 350 people out there on some nights. There's usually a cool breeze blowing. It's just really, you know, you can buy your dinner down at Farmer's Market and bring it over with your lawn chair and sit and listen to the bands. It's really good.
So how long has this been going on?
This is our sixth season.
Why did you start this event? What was the rationale?
A Fresno native, Doug Brimseth, loved to play banjo, and he got hired by the Shady Grove Band and moved to North Carolina for 13 years. Back there, a lot of the parks always have bluegrass music, so when he moved back here, he looked around, and him and Kelly Broyles found this spot and set it up, and that's how we got started.
Does the Valley have a big bluegrass community, both as fans and also as musicians? It's not something that maybe I immediately think of as being a huge thing in the area, but looking at the number of bands and seeing the number of people who come out to the events, it sounds like it's a sizable group of folks.
It really is. There's eight different bluegrass organizations in California, and we're with the California Bluegrass Association. There's a lot of bluegrass bands and a lot of great musicians.
So what type of groups do you have performing at the weekly concerts in the park? Are they, some of them, I guess, are professional groups. Some of them are sort of backyard bands or garage bands, I guess you could say.
Yes, you could. It's different calibers, different types of music. Red Dog Ash performed earlier in the year. They open the stage on Thursday morning for Grass Valley, which is the largest West Coast bluegrass festival up near Sacramento. Then we have other bands that, you know, just kind of play locally here. We have old-time bands, some country bands, some bands that kind of play a little bit of everything. It's really a diverse group that comes out, and a lot of fun to listen to the way they do the songs.
Stan Allen is our guest today from the Kings River Bluegrass Festival. Every Friday night, or just about every Friday night during the summer, they take a few weeks off when it gets really hot, but just about every Friday night in the summer, they host an event called Bluegrass in the Park, which is in Old Town Clovis, right outside the old Clovis High School. Now it's the law school there?
Yes, the San Joaquin Valley College of Law, and it's between that and the Memorial Building.
It's a fun event, but it's also just one of the things your organization does. And the other big one is the Kings River Bluegrass Festival. This has been around for a while under a couple of different names, but now it's called the Kings River Bluegrass Festival.
Yes. I think the last 5 years it's been the Kings River Bluegrass Festival in conjunction with the California Bluegrass Association.
And this is coming up in September 27th through 29th. And this is a big statewide event.
Yes, it is. We get a lot of people travel a lot. You can come in on Monday and start camping and just jamming. And then the music starts at 3 o'clock on Friday and runs through 2 o'clock on Sunday.
Now, again, you also have some of the familiar bands from the local area, the Grass Kickers and Uncle Aoife's, but you also have some out of town groups as well.
Yes, we're very pleased this year to have Lori Lewis as our headline band. She'll be performing Saturday and Sunday, and Red Dog Ash, the Central Valley Boys, Bean Creek. These are all upcoming bands from the California Bluegrass Association, and they are great performers.
Tell me a little about Lori's music.
Lori is a very wonderful person. I've heard her a couple times as she's been in Fresno before. A great person to talk to. Writes a lot of songs, like Kathy Mattea has recorded some of her stuff. She has been named IBMA Performer of the Year twice, which is the International Bluegrass Association. She's also won Song of the Year once. When she first got into it, she won several fiddle contests. And her band is just awesome.
Again, we're talking with Stan Allen of the Kings River Bluegrass Festival. Not only do they put on that festival in September, they also do the weekly concerts in the park, Bluegrass in the Park, on Friday nights in Old Town Clovis, Fridays through September 13th at the park right between the Veterans Memorial Building and the San Joaquin Valley College of Law on 5th Street. And this Friday night,
it's going to be a great show. Bring your lawn chair and come out. And if you don't have a lawn chair, we even have some chairs that you can borrow and sit there.
Great. Stan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Joe, thank you. We appreciate it.
That's all for this edition of Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org. And if you are a social media fan, follow us on Twitter @kvpr and at Valley Edition, also on Facebook as well. Let's type in Valley Public Radio. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero and company, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. See you next week.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.